The Sunstone Foundation presents Corporations and Their Effects on Mormon Family Values. Recorded live at the 1989 Sunstone Symposium, held August 23rd through 26th in Salt Lake City, Utah. We now take you to the University of Utah campus where the program is about to begin.
I think we're past time to start. I'd like to welcome everyone to, this is session 49, Corporations and Their Effects on Mormon Family Values. With a topic like that, it kind of reminds me of that the one Calvin Grondahl cartoon which shows a gospel doctrine teacher at the head of his class, and the statement he makes is, today's lesson is on repentance, but it will deteriorate into a discussion of ancient American airfields. I'm hoping that, you know, this topic, it can go a lot of directions, and I think the panelists we have assembled here have kind of an eclectic background in a lot of ways, and so hopefully we can look at this thing from different angles, because truly it is something that deserves to be looked at. Quoting from Marilyn French's Beyond Power, who in turn is quoting, from Simone Weil, says that up to the present, mankind has known two principal forms of oppression. The one, slavery or serfdom, exercised in the name of armed force. The other, in the name of wealth, transformed into capital. What we have to determine is whether these are not now being succeeded by a new species of oppression, oppression exercised in the name of management. Corporations and corporate structure can be a very scary kind of thing to some people. To others, it can be a very secure kind of thing. But I think the one underlying assumption we need to start with before the panelists begin talking is that the structure of an organization affects its members regardless of its stated purpose or intent. Whether or not an institution or organization is set up as a totally benevolent organization does not excuse it from the inherent strengths or weaknesses of the structure that has been selected to operate that organization or institution. So with that in mind, we can proceed. Let me first introduce who's here. My name is Jim Lindsay. I will act as the moderator. I have had experience in formal corporations, so at least I have that kind of background. I'm part owner in a company which designs computer-based training. Starting on my right over here is Joe Bennion. Lives in Spring City, Utah. He is a potter by trade. He is also a part-time instructor for BYU in the art department. Next over here is John Targin. Is that right? John Targin, who comes to us from Cal State Berkeley, where he's an associate professor of management. Cal State Bakersfield. Okay. No charge for the promotion either. Associate Professor of Management Information Systems. And let's see, his wife is here. He has two children. Final panelist here is M. Lou Chandler. She's a manager, an ad agency, an international company. And she's also a regional LDS public communications director for the Philadelphia area. She was also Salt Lake City's first female disc jockey. I'm sure that's relevant to almost any topic you get into. I think it's important. That is important. And what I'll have each of the panelists indicate either at the start or in the process of their comments is what their experience with corporations is, because we're coming from different angles and perspectives here, and I think it's important that you as the listeners and participants understand what that perspective is. So let's see, we'll go ahead in the order indicated in the program here. So we'll start with Joe.
Thank you. I'd like to clarify the introduction. My wife is also here, Lee Benyon, Lee Udall Benyon, and she's a painter. We have three daughters, and Spring City, by the way, is a very nice small place, about 700 people, in right in the center of Utah, and we both work as artists. And as far as my knowledge of corporations, I am not well-versed in the corporate system. I describe myself before out in the hall of the gym as maybe being corporophobic, which may or may not be a handicap in this situation. I've titled my remarks, Corporations and Families, a Radical View. In looking at what corporations and families are about, what drives them, holds them together, and where they are going, I see two very different systems of values. I see one system intent on having, and one system more concerned with being. I see one that is by nature competitive, and another that must be cooperative. I see a system that requires men and women to forsake the household to succeed, and one that must surely fail if they do. I also see in many corporations a value system that is dominated by money, fame, and power. In the family, important themes are love, faith, and humility. In short, I see the old conflict between the world and the kingdom of God. Zion and Babylon are and always have been at odds. They cannot coexist. The family, if it fulfills its purpose, brings the individual to Zion. Zion's underlying principle is the golden rule. This makes no sense to the world. It doesn't pay. For Zion, the church is the institution that brings its principles to the family. In Babylon, the corporation with its media arm does the same. The gospel of the world is readily available in TV ads and magazines. By example, corporations teach the ethics and economics of Babylon. Materialism is at the heart of the conflict between having and being. Perhaps life's greatest test is how we relate to our material blessings. We can either concern ourselves with getting and having things, or we can devote our energies to the process of becoming. As Hugh Nibley has pointed out many times, work is a blessing and a necessity, but the lunch is free and should not be our concern. How we provide for ourselves does make a difference. Families that work together on producing home commodities like food, fuel, clothing, and entertainment gain something that can't be bought. They naturally become closer, more cooperative, and interdependent. In gardening particularly, the family is strengthened by producing what it needs. In the process of preparing, planting, and harvesting, people learn principles like faith, humility, and stewardship. Relationships to each other, our heavenly parents, and the being we call Earth are clarified. In a world plagued by ill-defined roles, a father can discover the true nature of masculinity by tilling the earth as Adam was instructed to do. Things learned in gardening are retained because the repeated activities become rituals rich in symbol. Another important function of home production is the sense of self-reliance and heavenly dependence it gives to families. As children work in the home, they feel necessary to the success of the unit. They feel united in a struggle of survival, and that with the help of God, it will work. Family home evening, as good as it may be, is basically a band-aid for families that are suffering as a result of shifting from a production orientation to one of consumption. Unfortunately, corporations must encourage families to produce and consume. Their motto seems to be, you can have anything in this world for money. In fact, if it is purchased or experienced away from the household, it is better, i.e. stylish, fun, convenient, and sexy. The advertising of the corporation has convinced many families that the productive work of the household is a drudge, and that fun, freedom, and leisure await the liberated family. With Western culture in general, most corporations encourage a linear viewpoint that is short-sighted and destructive. The corporation is primarily concerned with getting ahead financially. It is owned by stockholders and must answer to them. It is difficult for the corporation thus oriented to think about environmental quality, future generations, or spiritual values. In this linear orientation, life is seen as an ever-forward proceeding. Connections are overlooked. The eventual return of life cycles is missed, and consequences of actions are not fully measured. If you would like to see examples of the results of linear thinking, I would suggest you go to Prince William Sound, Chernobyl, rural Kentucky, Love Canal, inner Detroit, or any downtown shopping mall. Families rooted in the gospel must learn to see in terms of cycles. From a cyclic perspective, our connection to each other, heaven, and nature are considered. All of Earth's systems are circles as are the heavens. By observing nature and participating with her in the garden, families can shift their perspective from linear to cyclic. In the cyclic picture, the corporation standards of success, money, power, and fame, are seen as superfluous. They lack cosmic relevance. We live in a society mired in the competitive spirit. It permeates our activities at work, at play, and at home. This is cause for concern. Competition at home certainly is a negative influence. I can think of no positive purpose for competition in the family setting. Rivalry for attention, power, and things tears families apart from the inside. Cooperation guided by love has to be the method in successful households. In business, competition is said to be necessary and healthy. I'm curious how that will be in Zion. If the golden rule was applied generally today, the business world would come crashing down. Yes, it is a fact that competition is good for business. That is, as long as we continue to do business as the world does. Competition is at heart a prideful thing. It divides people and puts them at odds with each other and with God. In a recent popular movie, a male CEO explains to a woman employee that men can, quote, have it all in the corporate world. By this, he means that a man can have a successful career and have a family. A woman must forego a family to reach the top in business. He, with a lot of other men, is badly mistaken. A family is not something you have like a second house or a collection of artwork. It requires the attention and sacrifice of two parents who are devoted to the household and who will consecrate themselves for it. Outside work, when necessary, is just that, outside work. Careerism is a false religion that flourishes at the expense of the household. Unfortunately, the work that men and women do at home goes largely without notice in the world. If a corporation teaches that a family should consume processed food and ready-made goods, seek quick and easy entertainment, and keep up with the Joneses, it is eroding primary values. If a corporation takes the loyalty and sacrifice of its men and women away from their homes, it robs those homes. If a corporation teaches its public that there are acceptable environmental risks and that we can afford to rob the lives and health of our grandchildren, then they are clearly an evil influence, and one would do well to get out of their employ, regardless of what becomes of him or her in the process. Perhaps this is a radical suggestion. It's not the first time it's been put forth. Thank you.
Well, I don't know where Joe got a copy of my paper, but I wish he would have cited me at least. No, actually, I'm taking a slightly different tack, and I'll just go ahead. I'm going to interject some comments my wife wrote on my paper here. So, in an earlier paper, as a matter of fact, 3 years ago, I argued that the primary metaphor or model that many members of the church identify with is that of a corporation. This metaphor is reinforced in many ways. Our heroes and leaders are, for the most part, successful businessmen. We use the language of corporations with words such as president, secretary, clerk, efficiency, programs, boards, goals, interviews, statistical reports, planning meetings, budget, authority, hierarchy, etc. Our visible symbols include the church office building, white shirts and ties, dark suits, efficient-looking ward buildings and temples, corporate logos, etc. Common stories include many stories of successful LDS businessmen, financial blessings, etc. Even our rituals such as meetings and promotion to church callings are orderly, structured, bureaucratic, and very non-charismatic. Men in the church have church careers. Professional education is encouraged. Goal setting and performance appraisal, that's personal priesthood interviews for those of you who haven't been to business school, are stressed. My aim is not to argue that corporations are bad or necessarily reinforce improper values or have adverse effects on people. In fact, corporate entities are in large part responsible, although this is an alternate voice, I guess, from Joe's, are in large part responsible for the creation of capital, division of labor, specialization, and professionalization of occupations that have provided those of us in the developed nations with a standard of living and lifestyle which I cherish. Even detractors of many of our society's values and institutions derive their freedom to dissent, at least indirectly, from the wealth generated by corporate entities. I am a professor of management and organizational behavior, which I guess I better digress. My experience with corporations, I forgot. Well, I guess I study them. I've worked at least for a short time at what was the largest bank in the world, and with a large management consulting firm, and for an oil company, only briefly. And it wasn't big enough to own those big tankers. Well, maybe it was. I also have done an organizational analysis of Intermountain Healthcare here, one of the larger healthcare providers. Worked for a defense firm, so I've experienced at least in a brief way many several different types of corporations. I believe that the same principles that I present to my students to help them make organizations more successful or to improve their organizational experiences also apply to the church. Bureaucracy is useful and needed by organizations such as the church in order to help them fulfill their mission. By bureaucracy, I mean authority, rules, chain of command, training, position by merit, etc. In fact, the reasons I began my doctoral studies in organizational behavior were, number one, that it helped me to understand my church experience more fully, and number two, that it held the promise of allowing me to contribute to the church in a greater way. Perhaps that was a bit naive, but that's one of my motivations. I continue to believe that the organizational studies field has a lot to offer the church and its members. However, there are some ideas and values that are promulgated in corporations which I feel are incompatible with the gospel and the mission of the church. I believe that other models or metaphors may be more appropriate than that of corporation for defining us as a church or as a people. The model I would recommend is the family. To me, church as a family has a lot more to offer than church as a corporation. To illustrate, I've attempted to enumerate several of the important ways in which a family organization differs from a corporate organization. Talking to these. I believe that dysfunctions occur when we adopt a corporate orientation in the church. However, before I proceed with my discussion, I want to point out that the characterizations of corporation and family are simplified and extreme in order to make my arguments clearer. Some families function quite well, at least on a surface level, following some aspects of the corporate model. And some corporations succeed while following the family model. In fact, a good deal of management literature suggests that many of the traits I've assigned to the prototypical family, in fact, describe the ideal corporation. First, on decision-making premises. In corporations, the president or the one with the most clout makes decisions. Underlings obey and try to gain favor. Decisions are centralized. Power and influence flow from the top down. I believe we follow this model when we make decisions based on organizational logic or position power rather than benevolence. When we implement programs regardless of their appropriateness for individual members. When top-down decision-making and flow of information are the only legitimate means of influence and control. When over-centralization of decision-making leaves little room for local autonomy or the development of talents and abilities of local leaders or other members. Family model. In a family, members sacrifice for the good of others. While decisions are made in an effort to preserve the family, the focus is on benefiting all family members. We follow this model in the church when we do what is good for ward members, regardless of how easy it is to do or how familiar or comfortable it feels. When people's needs are stressed over Salt Lake-initiated programs or the selfish desires of those in authority. When members are encouraged to innovate and grow within the structure of the church. Relationships with other members. In corporations, there is cutthroat competition for promotions. People produce or they are severed from the organization. Competition is the key to survival. The organization gets ahead at the expense of other competing organizations. The corporate church model. We follow this model when we compete for callings, esteem, or recognition rather than helping one another to succeed. When core members are chided rather than encouraged and helped. When we adamantly fight for our views, preferred activities, etc., rather than finding a common ground. When we judge others and compare our relative worth rather than helping others to become better or happier. I saw this in my mission when my general authority mission president hit the roof when another South American mission, quote, beat us in baptisms 1 month. In my earlier paper, I said I imagine it's like what would happen at Coke headquarters if Pepsi had passed them in market share. My wife wrote in here, the idea is that we have no worth unless we are the best. And maybe that's we use a very, very male metaphor if you went to the male session last night in the church sometimes. Families. In families, all family members work together to make the family succeed. Survival is contingent upon cooperation. Family church model. I believe I saw a nearly perfect example of this model in action in my newly divided ward in Monterey. We leaders pull together with no notions of separation of concerns or duties when considering people's needs. There was no territory or concern over who was in charge. In addition, never once did I hear statistical or other comparisons with other wards in the stake. Measures of effectiveness. Corporations focus on efficiency. The bottom line is the bottom line, namely profits. Corporations also tend to concentrate on external success with measures of effectiveness such as market share and the ability to attract resources. The corporate church model. We follow this model when we stress the number of converts over retention or development of our members. When sacrament meeting attendance rather than enjoyment or spiritual fulfillment is all that is discussed. When home teaching statistics are consistently stressed but the spiritual health of the ward is not discussed. In families, families stress effectiveness rather than efficiency with such measures as love, respect, closeness, and openness. Families also focus on the internal dynamics and experiences of family members rather than comparing themselves to other family units. The family church model. We follow this model when we discuss things such as spiritual health, enjoyment, faithfulness. When we concentrate on the progress, or maybe just faith, when we concentrate on our progress as a ward or other unit without the need to compare ourselves to other similar groups. Positional focus. Getting ahead is the ultimate goal in corporations. Positions are stepping stones. Career advancement is equated with success. We adopt the corporate church model when we view our responsibilities as rewards for merit and as stepping stones for greater influence, prestige, etc., rather than as opportunities to benefit others and as responsibilities for their well-being. I might add, it reminds me of some individuals that I've seen, one within my extended family now, who went very high up the church hierarchy, got to regional representative and stopped, and a devastating effect that had for that individual's self-worth, at least as perceived by me. Family. And families, membership is a sacred calling to help one another. Membership in family is a responsibility. We view ourselves based upon how we perform as parents, children, siblings, grandchildren, aunts and uncles, etc. In the family church model, we are operating under this model when we view our worth not by positions or financial success, but by the quality and depth of our compassion and service to others, when we identify with prophets rather than priests, if you're familiar with those metaphors. When we have much more interest in helping weaker members to catch up so the group can move as a unit rather than getting ahead individually or by the failure of others. I thank Janet for that one. Rewards. If we do a good job, we will be promoted in due course and be offered other tangible rewards in corporations such as money and recognition. We follow the corporate church model when we spend our time in pursuit of prestigious positions or wealth rather than improving relationships. When fathers don't spend time at home. When a father's need to be a successful provider or leading light or church leader outweighs parental responsibilities. And I don't mean to slight career women, but it's more common for men, I think, to view their self-esteem or to have their self-esteem derived from those accomplishments. When blessings, either in this life or promised blessings in the life to come, are our motivating force. My wife overheard someone in the clerk's office say, "We better get some good rewards for this in the next life because it sure has been a lot of work." And the idea is, does that mean that if there was no promise of reward in the next life that the church work wouldn't get done or that they wouldn't be willing to do it? In families, the chief rewards are the closeness and love of other family members and the satisfaction of seeing them grow and succeed. The family church model. We operate under this model when we gain our church-related satisfaction from being a part of the ward family, a community of believers, when service and brotherhood and sisterhood are their own reward, when good actions are done for the benefit of others and the good of society rather than for future reward. Primary allegiance. In corporations, it's the world of the corporate man. The corporation is the primary influence in where we live, when and how we relate to others. For example, if the corporation beckons, a corporate man will move during his child's senior year in high school. I didn't have as many examples. I would go on a little bit long, but I think that's a kind of a dramatic one that I've seen. Corporate church model. This is our model of decisions affecting the family are based upon the needs of the church organization rather than on the needs of family members or ward members. For example, when home teaching is attended to, but a child's soccer game is missed. Family. In families, family members come first. The family must be protected at all costs. Family church model. Under this model, callings are accepted after polling all family members about their feelings. Ward members can indicate which callings they would or would not like to fill. Participation in church activities is based on the desires and needs of the individuals involved. Stake presidents do not use a heavy hand to impose organizational conformity or discipline on bishops, other leaders, or other members. members and local leaders are allowed to modify or reject programs based on local needs. I have to go back to one comment that I wanted to put in here. Oh, referring back to the Monterey Ward, problems of members were discussed and creative measures were used to solve them. We were not limited to the suggestions and manuals. Okay, in conclusion, what is the importance of these ideas? I believe the top leaders in the church, middle-level leaders, local leaders, and all members have a duty to choose appropriate models to guide their values, their attitudes, and their behaviors. Unfortunately, we seem to have adopted a corporate metaphor which may carry with it some inappropriate and undesirable values. I believe that the gospel as taught by Jesus is compatible, indeed is inseparable from the family model. The corporate model as described in this paper is antithetical to that gospel. It is up to each of us to shun the corporate model and to embrace or view ourselves as a church family. Thank you.
My husband is not here. He's at the computer at my parents' house desperately trying to finish a roadshow before, so that he can Federal Express it back to Philadelphia before Saturday. So glad I paid for his Sunstone registration. At any rate, I'm not here as an organizational psychologist. I'm not here as a corporate vice president. I'm not here as a sociologist. What I am is someone who is rather intimately involved with two large international corporations. I manage an advertising department for a Philadelphia-based corporation, and I handle public relations for the church on a regional basis. And though I'm not, and though I've had my fair share of negative experiences with these two corporations, I find myself in the role of an apologist for both of these organizations. And I do have some thoughts to share with you along these lines. But before I get too far into that, I think it's appropriate to comment briefly on the manner in which corporations affect women and how that impacts society, because those factors most certainly affect the family. The phenomenon of the glass ceiling is very real in corporate America. My corporation, for example, employs many women in highly responsible positions, and women are promoted to first-level and mid-level management. But they are not able to penetrate through that glass ceiling into the vice presidential level. And it's not for lack of knowledge, it's not for lack of skill, and these days it's not for lack of political savvy. I don't mean to suggest that women don't ever break through that glass ceiling, but it's rare in corporate America, and it's never happened in my corporation. As take a guess. Neither one of them. The one that pays me and the one that doesn't pay me. Neither. As a result, the signals to women in the corporation that pays me are clear. Their opportunities for advancement are limited as a result, and as a result, the most capable women, many of the most capable women, are leaving the large corporations in droves to start businesses of their own. And it's estimated that by the year 2005, over 50% of the businesses in America will be run by women. These are small businesses, many of them cottage industries, at least they still will be during the early part of the next century. Simultaneously, the baby boom generation is growing up. And even now, for the first time in our country's history, there are more people who are over 65 than people who are teenagers. Now, what that means is as a society, the workplace has got to find some workers from another source, or else we are not going to be able to maintain our level of whatever. Where am I? Our standard of living, that's right. And where is the workplace going to look for those workers? They'll have to look to women. 50% of the women today do not work outside of the home, and that's fine. We think that's... I'm not going to get into that. At any rate, because of the limitations on women in the corporate arena, women will be drawn to the smaller corporations, the smaller businesses, rather. And I think we'll see an emergence of an almost equally powerful, if not more powerful, old girls network. Now, personally, I'd like to see the end of the old boys network and the old girls network. But, assuming that doesn't happen, it appears to me that the workplace will be more, or at least equally, affected by small businesses as by large corporations in the years to come. Now, whether that trend is helpful or detrimental to the family could be debated either way. I'll leave it to the determination of the sociologists. But now, having said all that, and notwithstanding the fact that I am a woman, I must state that I believe that there is a place for large corporations in the world. Now, I'm not so sure about those corporations that go around engulfing other corporations, but what I'm talking about here are large, rather single-purpose corporations. In many instances, they serve a purpose that could not possibly be fulfilled by smaller organizations. Now, for example, my corporation in Pennsylvania provides hospitals with computer systems for hospital-wide information processing. Now, smaller companies could only provide pieces of computer systems for various departments in the hospital, none of which would talk to each other efficiently or be able to share information in an efficient way. Now, that scenario is detrimental to quality patient care and creates a huge drain on productivity in the hospital, which escalates healthcare costs. Yet the delivery of a totally integrated hospital-wide information system requires the resources of a fairly big company. Now, I want to digress briefly and comment on your foil, may I? Say yes.
Oh, yes.
The comment that I'd like to make is that my experience in corporate America is that corporations do not necessarily think that this list of character traits are positive. Most companies these days send people to management training, or they have in-house management training. And I can tell you that what you learn in those management training courses are these kinds of things. So whether it's in the family or in the corporation or in the small business, these things certainly exist in all arenas. But I think if we're genuine people inside and outside the church, I found that most people really are shooting for these higher goals. End of soapbox. Okay. So, what's wrong with large corporations? In my view, the fundamental thing that's wrong with large corporations is the same thing that's wrong with all organizations in society, right down to the family. They're run by people. People who are not perfect. People who make mistakes. The difference is that when a large corporation makes a mistake, it affects a lot more people. And the larger corporation has a much larger labyrinth of bureaucracy and red tape. But the trend toward management theory these days is toward corporate decentralization. And I've lost my place again. Which effectively contains the dramatic impact of mistakes and serves to slice through much of the red tape. The church, of course, is a bit behind corporate America in the realm of decentralization. But I am happy to report that it is seriously looking at the need to pursue ways to decentralize. And I think that's very positive. I'd just like it to accelerate a little bit. Okay, getting back to the larger issue. Why is it that when something bad happens and a large corporation is involved, we naturally assume, and the media naturally assumes, that there's something very inherently evil at the root, or that it's really rotten to the core? I have to report that in my experience, almost invariably, I found that the source of the problem to be rather innocent stupidity. And we're all capable of innocent stupidity. Now, I'm not naive enough to believe that there aren't unscrupulous people out there with ulterior motives, but I really believe that those people are very much in the minority. Let me offer an example. My company has been reorganizing, and about 9 months ago, the entire marketing arm of the company was turned upside down. Now, fortunately for me, my own department was untouched because my people are specialists and can't move laterally in the company. And nobody outside of advertising understands advertising anyway, so they pretty much leave us alone. At any rate, the net effects of that reorganization elsewhere in this marketing arm saw virtually all the women in the area demoted and the men promoted. It was very hurtful and very painful. And the women on my staff who observed this assumed that it was intentional and malicious. And though I, too, was very angry about it, about the turn of events, I found myself again in the role of the apologist. The reality of the situation was that the old boys' network was in full sway. The man heading the area picked a couple of other people who happened to be men to fill certain positions. And they picked a couple of other people who happened to be men. And this small group got together off-site to further outline the new structure. Now, my manager was the highest-ranking woman in the area, but initially their deliberations didn't affect her initially. So it didn't occur to them to include her. It also didn't occur to them to get a woman's view on what they were doing because it didn't occur to them that women were being excluded from this decision-making forum. I mean, they're used to seeing women around all the time, and women are in their meetings all the time, and suddenly women weren't there, and they didn't notice. And they didn't realize the net effect of what happened to the women's careers until after the reorganization had been announced. Now, I know these men well. I've worked closely with them. I like them, and I know that they would not have consciously wanted to hurt anyone, and that if they had recognized the effects, they would have made some adjustments. But the error wasn't so much with the men themselves. It was with our tendency as a people to associate rather exclusively with our own kind. Granted, we work together, we go to meetings together, but when it comes to going to lunch and associating with each other in the foyer after sacrament meeting, we gravitate to our own kind. Each day I look down on one of our large atrium lunchrooms to see the blacks sitting together, the women sitting together, and the white men sitting together. Tables with mixed company are definitely in the minority, and half the time a mixed group is actually having a business lunch. And by the way, I see similar groupings in the foyer, I've already mentioned that, at church after sacrament meeting. I'm sure you have too. Notice. Well, the subject of this session is not women's issues, so I'll get off that. And on to a little bit about the church as an organization. In my life and my calling, I must make a strong distinction between the church and the gospel. To me, the gospel is the thing on which my testimony is founded. The church, on the other hand, is an organization made up of imperfect people striving to become perfect. It is the gospel that's true. The church is neither true nor false, good nor bad. It is a necessary structure. Many of us would like to see that structure changed. I know I have my list. But it will continue to exist as an organization of one sort or another. I think the thing that has helped me most lately dealing with the innocent and well-meaning stupidities that I've found in this church organization was Dr. Bassett's comments at the last Sunstone Symposium. Let me quote just a little bit of that. Quote, "Do we understand the role of the church as a catalyst in our development? It seems to me that the church serves a very vital role in the development of wholeness and proper spiritual. It provides, as it were, a semi-protective rehearsal hall for our role in attempting to develop Peter's principles." Now, he's referring here to the divine character traits in 2 Peter chapter 1. "It, like our families, gives us a chance to practice those principles with others who theoretically have the same commitment and to talk about what we experience. And then, from this springboard, we should be prepared to carry the experiment further into the wider world. But we need to note that the church serves a dual purpose in this process. It's not only a comfort station, it can also become the cross we bear. And we need to anticipate both types of experiences within the church." I recently heard of a woman who stopped attending church because she felt it didn't serve any purpose in her life anymore, didn't provide the intellectual stimulus that she desired. I suspect she was thinking of it in the first sense, as a first aid stop. But in reality, the church brings us in close contact with people who disappoint us and constantly rub us the wrong way. I suspect the Lord planned it that way. I rather doubt that. Nevertheless, the church, our church experience serves a vital role in our practice for the larger world and for life in an eternal sense. If we're committed to that experiment, the church places us in close contact with people who we might ordinarily avoid in life, and there's no way of getting away from them, locked as we are in the same ward. We might even find them presiding over us, patience with the bishop's mistakes, long-suffering with that Sunday school class, temperance with the seemingly unending demands of the church, brotherly kindness, charity, and the list goes on. It's in the church situation that we get some of the best experience, the best practice in life regarding what it means to be Christian. End quote. Now, by this, I would not advocate that we shouldn't work for change and/or decentralization in our church corporate structure. I would advocate, however, that no matter how flawed we may think our church organization to be, it can have value for us, if in no other way than through the experience we gain as we strive to achieve change in a more Christ-like way. Thank you.
We'd now like to open it up to questions from the floor. We'll try to restate the question, and you can either direct it to a particular panelist or just to the panel in general, and we'll decide among ourselves who's best to do it or whoever wants to do it. First hand was in the back there. I think the question has to do with, our feelings or our ideas about legal family corporations and how they operate and whether they are good or bad or what kind of effect they have on the family. Do you want to direct that to anyone in particular or just, okay.
First of all, it's a little slightly different topic than what we're talking about. That's kind of a moral issue. Although I will address just real briefly this idea of families as corporate entities as far as a family business. There's a professor down at BYU, Gib Dyer, who studied quite extensively what happens to families and all that. And I've seen a little bit of that, and we know that it usually tears families apart, that it's difficult to maintain the same values and standards that are necessary for a corporation to succeed and for families to succeed. And it's very, very difficult for those to work together.
Well, there is an ancient Hebrew counterpart for the corporation. I mentioned it in my paper, and that's Babylon. The reason that families incorporate is completely opposite to the reason that families come together. Families come together for eternal life. Families come together to procreate, to find God, and to have the experience of having that, or of being that, I should say. Families incorporate so they can hang on to the things they're trying so desperately to have, which are the things that we should have not any concern for. It's the same reason that families blow up when they try to litigate wills. It's as simple as that. Orienting yourself towards things instead of towards the process of becoming tears people and families apart and takes them away from God.
And eventually tears corporations apart, too, if that's the only goal.
Next question is right back here.
Yeah, I'll try to see what I have for you. The first one, John?
Yes.
When you listed your things, to me, one of the fundamental differences that I'd like to comment on is you include would be the purpose of the family as opposed to the purpose of the corporation. It seemed like the purpose of the corporation is profit. And what is the analogous point of family effect? The second question, I'd like to go to the panel, and it's a larger question. And one that I'm not sure society has an answer for, but might have any effects. And women are certainly going into the workplace, which is a movement that I strongly support. I also strongly support, if you heard my presentation last night, you know, males being more flexible in terms of family responsibilities. But one thing as a therapist and running a nonprofit organization that I've become acutely aware of is that society, because you know, in terms of the change of the workplace, I think that that's both positive and necessary. And we tend to judge everything in our culture economically, and it's an economic necessity. But I'm getting more and more into my program and children that are absolutely not raised, a lot of character disorders, personality disorders. One of the things that was discussed, the effect of our corporate mentality in America, because I don't think we get the same equation to love of human connectedness is the effect of who's raising the children, not from a male or a woman perspective, but from a societal perspective. And I would like to preface that comment with it. I think going back to the romantic conservative vision that, well, man works, woman stays home, and that takes care of it, doesn't work. And then for the most part, that doesn't exist. But society has changed economically without a corresponding societal change of how we socialize our young. And it's, you know, you take the city of Chicago, over 50% of the children are now illegitimate. Over 20% of our children are born teenagers. And we haven't, as a culture, as a society, because we have, well, I would say because we have a corporate mentality, we moved in one way economically without a corresponding, and I don't know what the answer is. I was wondering if anybody got some creative things about, since we're moving economically, how do we also think societally about how we socialize our young?
Okay, thank you. I have two questions here. The first one directed to John has to do, what is the counterpart to the profit motive of the corporation in the family? And the second one deals with, I guess, how can we foster change, or what kind of change is in the horizon of corporations or society looking to its needs as corporations begin to change economically, or at least as the workplace begins to change. That is, more women are going into the workplace, but it does not appear that more men are spending more time with their families or taking part in that particular responsibility. Let's start with John.
Yeah, well, the first thing I'd like to point out is I'm feeling a little uncomfortable with our seating arrangements here on the left and the right. In my ward, I'd be out in the other room on things. But okay, let me address that first question. If you could, thanks.
Sorry. Right.
Yeah. Well. Okay. Yeah. Goals. I guess your goals are measured, or how we do based on these types of things. And excuse me for writing on the board, but I'm going to do it. Pretend like I'm teaching my art theory class. There are kind of four competing models of goals or orientations, and have to do with the focus. And one variable would be this idea of efficiency, effectiveness, and an internal focus. Versus an external focus. So organizations that are internally efficient get a lot from their workers and don't pay them very much, maybe, or just very efficient at producing goods and services. Organizations that are efficient externally can sell things cheaper and therefore make a lot of profit. So I guess here's money and here's cheaper and expensive production. Internal effectiveness means happy workers. And external effectiveness would be the things that Joe says, that no corporations really are maybe neglected a little bit, but that's kind of environmental things. Corporate responsibility, customer satisfaction, providing some service to society that's valued, maybe above and beyond the cheap good. Now, I've argued before that I think the problem with the church is that sometimes we focus justly on internal processes, but it's more efficiency. How many ward buildings can we put up? Why do we? Yeah, we put up ward buildings without windows. I mean, you know, the greatest symbolism in the world is that light and knowledge and all that, and yet we close ourselves away from that and build these temples that have very little meaning for me anyway, symbolic meaning, and concentrate on efficiency. And I think the problem is that in corporations we have a very much efficiency focus rather than effectiveness, and we deal externally with the environment rather than internally. The goal of the church that I see and that I would argue for and the family model is the goal is to make people grow, feel happy, feel secure, give them a secure home base where they can grow and develop. Whereas corporations, the number one, the deciding factor is whether they survive or not, they attract resources from the environment. So I think that, was that, did that answer?
Yeah.
Okay.
I think, maybe, let's have, Lou, do you want to address the second part of that question having to do with how society is going to have to transform, the workplace transforms?
Well, as you said, one of the higher objectives of corporations pertains to profit, although I think if that's all it is, they don't last very long. But anyway, there are studies, and there will be more, that point out the fact that when the corporation takes a responsible role in the raising of the children and helping out and having daycare centers on site, the productivity increases dramatically. And the more we encourage those kinds of studies to come about, and they are coming about, the more corporate America will recognize that they need to do that. The other thing is, as a church, I hear more and more in groups like this, why are those church buildings vacant during the day? I mean, if we care about our children, I mean, certainly the church encourages women to be at home with their children, but if that reality does not exist, let's not stand on our pride, and let's get daycare centers in our wards so that we're caring for each other, for our children appropriately. And I don't think that's going to happen from the top down. The only way that's going to happen is for some of us at the grassroots level to say, hey, Bishop, I'm caring for Sister Jones and Sister da-da-da-da-da kid, and my house is a little too small. Could I just use the primary room and let it grow that way? It's the only way it's going to grow. Oh, excuse me.
Next question here.
I hate long breaks in tapes.
It's like people's
court. As I read the topic of the conference today, corporations and their effects on Mormon family values, I don't really feel like it's been addressed yet in this session. As I listened to Joe, his approach was basically a retreat from corporations and don't know how to avoid any involvement with the corporation setting. And I really haven't heard anything in the papers about the effect of the corporation on the family. I've heard of comparisons between corporation and families and church, etc. But I would like somebody to talk to the issue of how can an individual effectively deal in a world of corporations where the corporation is placing increasing demands and responsibilities on the individual, and the individual also feels increasing responsibilities in a home and a family that has to exist in a society fraught with the problems we live with today. How does an individual deal effectively in that world?
You want to direct that to anyone in particular? Or?
No, anybody who'd like to address it.
Well, I have something hanging over from, I can't remember your name.
Glenn.
asked about that idea of change and accommodation, and I think the whole thing. More to me, this whole idea of corporate America and large organizations and the fast pace of society and the change in society is more of a cultural issue. In the United States, we don't have very many long-standing cultural traditions, and therefore we don't have the institutions to help us accommodate to change. I don't see the in Sweden they seem to have solved this daycare issue and dual careers and women leaving and father parental leave and all those other things. But in our nation, because it's so heterogeneous or eclectic or whatever you want to call it, we don't have a culture that can, and people don't share enough common values and beliefs to come up with institutions to help us deal with it. But anyway, what can we do? I don't know. I dropped out. I got an MBA from a top school, and I'm teaching so I can spend time home with my kids. I hear sometimes corporations saying the presidents get up and give these addresses and say, well, we have to address this issue. As corporations, we've got to provide for the next generation because where will we find our workers? Well, you know, I find that a very, mercenary kind of idea. I mean, there should be a higher value other than just finding more workers to make more profits. And I don't think that it's up to corporations to do that. I'm sorry. I think that religious leaders and political leaders are the ones that have to take the lead in that. But.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
What was I going to comment on? I had much sleep. Thank you. The issue of the pressures of corporate America and the fact that we have this concept that they have to, you know, people in corporate America are away from the family too much. I'm sorry, but that is not an issue that pertains to corporations. That's an issue that pertains to people who have a workaholic personality. And whether you're in a large corporation, a small corporation, or if you're a farmer, if you have that kind of a personality, and if you find greater greater fulfillment in the workplace, you're going to be very tempted to stay there. I'm very, very tempted to stay late at the office. It's very difficult for me to tear myself away. And I think that men and women who don't tear themselves away are really being weak. They can succeed without that. It's possible. You can organize yourself well enough. I think it's a personality issue, and I see it as much in small business and even home cottage industries as I see it in corporate America.
Could, but I think it was summed up nicely by the person who made the question.
Let me just make let me add just one comment to that. Any time we start talking about accommodation to the corporate nature of our society, that is a one-way accommodation. There is no equal accommodation. Corporate structures are such that they demand that people subsume their values when they join them. And so to accommodate, a person has to learn to live with that because they can't change it. As long as the corporation is the way it is, that's always going to be a one-way accommodation. Now, John Sculley in his book Odyssey, which is a fascinating book to read sometime, he talks about his transformation mentally of going from PepsiCo, which was as formal second wave corporations you can find anywhere in America, to Apple Computer, which he describes as a third wave company, talking about the difference in them. And in his book, he just briefly, let me mention some of the, he talks about the difference in the structures and summarizes them this way, that as far as organization goes, a second wave company is into hierarchy. Third wave companies are into networks. The output of a second-wave company is market share. The output of a third-wave company is market creation. Focus. Second-wave companies focus on the institution. Third-wave companies focus on the individual and style. One is structured. The other is flexible. Source of strength. Well, the one is stability.
The other is flexibility, or change, rather. Structure, one is self-sufficient, the other is interdependent. Culture in the one is traditional, the other is what he refers to as a genetic code. It's more of a biological kind of thing of adapting to change as it appears. Quit relying on tradition. Quit making tomorrow look like an extension of yesterday. Rather, adapt to change and move on. Talks about the mission of the one being goals and strategic plans, the other being identity, directions, and values. And he goes on from there. But the notion is, when I think of accommodation, when you accommodate to a bad situation, you have a bad situation. I don't think there is a good accommodation with traditional corporate America the way it now stands. Next question.
I have mostly a comment and a question at the end. Let me just say I have a home-based corporation. And I have four children from ages 5 to 14, and I've chosen to work out of my home and not leave my home. And but there's a lot of things that work against me. And what I'd like to see is more laws change to allow more of this kind of work for women. What happens is I employ quite a few women. And but what happens is the lobbyists, they come to my home and get work, and then they go home and work. Okay, so they're working at home as well. And most of these women earn $8 to $9 an hour. And one woman who works for me has 7 children, age 11 to 2. There's no way she can go out in the workforce and make what she's making and pay child care. So she works at home when she can work and makes $7 or $9 an hour doing it. And but what happens is the big lobbyists for the big manufacturing companies don't like home workers because they have to put their women in factories and pay them health care and all that kind of stuff. And so they don't like the advantages that we have by having home workers. And the state regulatory agencies don't like the fact that, the UPS truck comes to my house every day and unloads boxes and boxes and boxes and then ships to me from my home basement. Because, the neighbors aren't sure they like, the truck coming, to my home. And, but I like it because I can stay home with my 5-year-old. And what I'm saying is you can have, what we need to have is more flexibility in corporations so that we can allow those who want to work at home to be able to do that. Without being harassed by, the huge corporations that see things done very traditionally rather than innovatively, like women have to do now in order to keep our home values and be with our kids when they get home from school and all those kinds of things that are, important to me as a woman. In a few years when my kids are all in school, I may not mind having a warehouse and working outside of the home 6 hours a day or something. But right now, I'm working 50 or 60 hours a week, but I'm home when my kids need me. And so I just want to, address, this to the panel and, what can be done innovatively to allow that kind of work.
Anybody on the panel want to make a comment? That was a well-made statement.
There's not much I can say to that except the fact that some corporations are doing that, and I would support that wholeheartedly. And I think your biggest problem, you brought up an excellent problem with corporations, and that is that they are a lobbying force, and that puts you at a disadvantage. But there are corporations that allow this. For instance, in if there is something that we can have women do, my department is by women, and we accommodate that. We send them home with computers, and they write, and they modem their stuff back to us. And we do accommodate that to some extent, and that's motivated by the fact that our corporate facility is
jam-packed, and so we do send them home. Go home, work at home, we don't have room for you here. But it's growing slowly, and I think that kind of cottage industry is tremendous.
I'm very appreciative of the things you said, and I'd like to take the focus off of women in this situation and maybe put it on men as well. Back to, you're all familiar with the movie I referred to, it's Baby Boom, where he said, you know, I can have it all. I can have a family, there they are right there on my lapel, and I can also climb to the top. And you can't, because biology says that you bear this child and then you have to nurse it, and, you know, that just takes a big hole out of you. And yes, women tend to be more in the home, but, you know, when Lee and I were getting established, or deciding to about 12 or 13 years ago, we made career decisions. I was not going into the education market. I was training at that time to be an elementary school teacher. That we both chose things that we could do at home and or close to home. My studio is a block away. Lee paints right in the house. And that's what we looked for. And I would like to see corporations that would allow their male employees also to maybe have a 3-day work week. I have a friend in Rome who's a dentist, and he chose to practice there and the way he did so that he could take 3 days off a week instead of the 2 that are given him, you know, that he could do dentistry 3 days and 3 days be home with his wife and his child. And what he did was he's his own employer, so he took a little cut in pay to do that. And I would like to maybe see a corporation that would allow men and women to maybe work a shorter work week, less benefits, less pay. I don't know, maybe that's being done. But be more flexible for both genders, because parenting is not a female-dominated sport, I think.
I have somewhat the same question that was raised. I wanted to hear more about the effect of corporations on family values. I do work for a corporation. It's not that I'm a workaholic. I think in Utah we do try to do a good job for a day's pay, but the corporation presses us for large amounts of overtime, deadlines. At the conclusion of every project, people are burned out. I happen to be a single parent, and I do have to work, not only to support myself, but my kids. I work with a woman whose husband is disabled, who supports the family, a man who has 7 children and is a bishop, a man who is in a bishopric, has 5 children, the youngest of which are infant twins, and we get burned out. Within our department, there's a lot of cooperation, but at the top, we have engineers who've read Thriving on Chaos. And in addition to our usual crises, we always seem to be operating in crisis mode, seem to feel that we need a little more chaos in addition to the natural chaos. What I'm wondering is, we've talked about what metaphors we can offer to the church. Rather than operating on the corporate model, perhaps we ought to consider the family model. What metaphor would John offer to corporations? Can a management theory be effective in the long run if it's founded on an extremely limited view of human beings?
It's all yours, John.
It's yours.
Well, I don't know how best to respond to that. I can say that there, in the organizational field, there's the most money being made right now is by consultants who come in and kind of expound the same values that have been expounded today. One of the organizations that's kind of held up on a pedestal is Delta Airlines, where they very much fit the family model. They don't lay people off, are very fluid in responsibilities, and identify very closely with one another. And so I think that organizations where creativity or service are stressed, and that's the way our economy is going, do follow the family model a lot more than Weber's ideal bureaucracy with the top-down authority and flow of information up and down rather than across, and those types of things. Now, let me remember what your exact question. Oh, what metaphors would be more appropriate for the corporation? Well, there are a lot of them that have been proposed. One of them was the kind of, dealt with chaos that Carl Weick uses, and I can't remember what he says, but it's got like a multi-headed monster that kind of goes in all directions. I don't think that serves to help help us as individuals. But the metaphors that are being used, I see as family very much, and there's a thing called Theory Z you may have heard about as a book, and talks about blending our American cultural corporate values with Japanese corporate values, and doing things like offering long-term employment and a holistic concern for employees, rather than just concern for their production and their their family life and making accommodations. And so I see a lot of movement. I think that we are following to a certain extent the family metaphor, and I think many corporations tend to think of themselves that way and describe themselves that way. The only point I was trying to make is that there's an idealized corporation, idealized family, and I feel much more comfortable with the family metaphor in the church, also in corporations. And maybe that's why I'm in education rather than using my MBA to make some money.
My question was that inasmuch as a corporate structure is a construct, really, where is it written in stone that they cannot make accommodation? They won't be exactly what they are, but all institutions have to change. They shatter or they bend and survive. And why isn't it possible that one of the things they can do is to try to accommodate, is a question of enlightened self-interest, the needs for child care centers on site as one of the things. Other things, too. I mean, to that, you could say, well, it accommodates women, but does it really in a society that seems to be beginning to become enlightened about parenting, being an equal opportunity situation?
So I guess I can start by making a comment on that, perhaps. Marilyn French, in her book Beyond Power, does a tremendous dissection of the power of corporate life or you know, the existence of corporations and how they fit into the overall hierarchy, the male hierarchy that really is the history of the world. And she does a great job in there talking about the power structure. And yes, some accommodation is going to happen, and yes, you are going to find third wave companies like Apple Computer, Hewlett Packard, maybe some others that have a reputation for being enlightened. But I feel, for the most part, that it's going to take a very major kind of transformation. It's going to have to be an economical one for formal corporations to change the way they work, the way they reward people, the kind of loyalty they expect, the way they coerce people to stay in line, the way managers operate in so much fear all the time, and the top down, the very vertical structure of it. I don't see that being something that's going to happen overnight. And it'll only happen, as was indicated before, as the pressures of society, perhaps the nature of the changing workplace, can get to the point where it puts so much stress on the traditional system that something has to give, and it is giving. It is giving, but whether or not it can transform into something different than what it is traditionally, because it is such a tribal kind of thing. I mean, the myth, the ritual, that we find in modern corporations is such that it's extending yesterday and into tomorrow to try to maintain it. Breaking that down and becoming more flexible, more biological, that is, adapting to change as it occurs, or as the need arises, as the pressure arises, that's the direction it should go. But again, that's you know, it doesn't mean it'll move there quickly. Anybody else? Yes.
Have any of you heard of Tom Peters? Tom Peters and others like him have written books, and they go out and give lectures and demonstrate the fact that corporations that cherish their people, that concentrate on service, that produce the highest quality, and have all these higher level motivations are in fact the most successful companies in America. And there is a wave of that. You know, his presentations are both entertaining and humorous, and you know, I remember at the end of one of them he said, you know, I'm an embarrassment to my family. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing. I come and I get paid these enormous amounts of money, and all I say essentially is, if you treat your people well, produce a high quality product, and concentrate on service, you'll make lots of money. Thank you very much, and goodbye. I mean, that really is true, and it's happening in America. All corporations aren't that way, but I see a wave, and as corporate senior executives wake up and realize that they could be making a heck of a lot more money by concentrating on the higher values, it's going to happen. And there are lots of examples out there.
I've seen at the beginning it seemed like there was a kind of a stereotype of a corporation versus a family model, which I think is a very good basis to start from, and I thought this has become a theme, and then how we go from corporation to family model and how they can be put together. As a matter of fact, I also have seen a whole gamut of corporate stereotypes. I've had excellent bosses who came from different corners of the world, and I've seen also different families with militaristic versus so-called thing. I remember an excellent, very well-respected corporate manager who asked, what is the secret of why you are so effective as a manager? He said, I learned it by trying to run an elders quorum. And it might have been extended and learned it by trying to run a family. He was effective in some of the corporate things of getting the job done. I've seen an Army sergeant type person who ran in a very effective family. The question I have now from all this is, what is the corpus callosum by which communication can be gotten from family to corporation, each of them, which I believe has something to offer to each other? I'm having a hard time finding a way to get the best of both worlds. How does this... what is there about getting some way of getting the communication between the two?
So that's my father-in-law, I get the first one.
I actually wish Joe had made a few more comments, because Hugh Nibley had that talk on the lunch is free.
Work we must.
Yeah, work we must, but the lunch is free. And I think basically the idea that most of us would agree with is, how do you change this idea, and how can we make corporations help the family accommodate and promulgate family values? Well, it's changing people's hearts. I mean, if we view ourselves as here on this earth to gain power and prestige and wealth and accumulate possessions and, you know, define ourselves by what we have rather than what we are and who we relate to and how we relate to them, no change will ever take place. Then the other one is, when we get a few mothers as heads of corporations, I think things will change very rapidly. Yeah, just like few mothers as heads of state, and we'd have fewer wars.
or sensitive fathers.
Last question.
It's more of a comment. I was thinking, my chair, that maybe I, probably no one else, was dumping too heavily on corporations, because in some ways, historically, if you go back 100 years, 150 years, the primary economic unit was the family, and that economics in many sense define the family, and that I'm not sure that motivations such as growth, love, were the primary motivating factors. You had large families because you had to survive economically, and that survival was the primary mentality. And that that you had to create efficiency, and you took your kids out of school or whatever to serve the survival and economic concerns of the family, and that's the way it's been for most of mankind. And it thought of me, because I love to dump on corporate America sometimes, that as the for most families, as that function has moved outside of the home, one thing that may have happened is it may have freed up families to be more concerned about such things as love, communication, growth that we previously could not be concerned about. It's at least a thought. I don't know if anyone wants to comment on it, but maybe the family in some ways had some better opportunities with economic change.
Thank you. Let's see, Let's go ahead and have a last short comment or summary statement by each of the panelists. We'll start with you, Joe.
First, I guess I should apologize for coming on as such a devil's advocate. Zion's advocate? Maybe that's a better... I believe that we are progressing towards a new age. Who is your friend's name? Tom
Peters,
Paul Hawken. People who are working at restructuring corporate America along more positive lines, I think, is moving in the right direction. The new age I see us moving into, of course, is a millennial period and a Zion-based economy. And we are going to have some means of production, et cetera. Everything can't be home-based. I guess I tend to hang clear over here and and talk about this home-based economy, just because I feel like, just like the Sierra Club has to be out there yelling and screaming at industry, someone has to be over there yelling and screaming in favor of the completely home-based economy as being the ideal. Certainly we live in a material world. I think we just need generally to have kind of a paradigm shift which will prepare us for that Zion-based thing to happen. Thank you.
One thing that I wanted to say earlier is that I think that, I do not disagree with a lot of things that Joe says. And if you look at the model of community and communitarianism that was promulgated by Brigham Young and Acts and Third Nephi and all those other places, City of Enoch and whatever, cooperation was the key and very much pulling together and accumulating things. And home-based industry and rural lifestyle is, to me, a little bit more compatible with that, or at least it's a little more possible. However, what do I want to say? Well, I guess maybe I just have a little more faith in societal institutions such as corporations and political processes. You know, when I view the Exxon Valdez, I don't view it as the problem of much having a large corporation that's able to afford a big tanker and is irresponsible, but you have a society that says you cannot discipline a drunk pilot and has to have the benefit of the doubt and can keep driving the ship even though he's a drunkard. Or in Bhopal, India, that there's some resentments and some other cultural institutions or artifacts created by British imperialism that maybe carries over and has something to say to the level of training and commitment to the workers over there. What I'm saying is that I have kind of an abiding faith long term that our institutions, political processes will end up solving society's problems, and that corporations are no better or worse than the people who run them, and in fact, like I said earlier, they are responsible for our lifestyle and our standard of living, which I think is good. It's the key to me is changing people's hearts, and maybe it's just the differences are the degree in faith we have and maybe some of those institutions.
So when you
unusual for a woman to have the last word.
Just
love
consider
it.
Her.
Oh, okay. speaking of changing people's hearts, the one thing that I would love to share with you is a surprise of mine. Being in corporate America, just before I left Utah, you know, and the women's movement was real strong in the 70s, and I remember a remark by Jane Ann Payne where she said, assertiveness training is selfishness training. And so then I went to Philadelphia and got embroiled in this corporation and went to an assertiveness training course. And you know what I learned that they were teaching? I mean, here's it. Assertiveness training does sound like a selfish term. Influence training sounds like a selfish term. Those are words to get people in the class. Do you know what they're teaching in those classes in corporate America? Christ-like principles. I mean, I sat there with my jaw open. I thought, I'm back in Sunday school. It really is. I mean, they don't mention Christ, although that has been mentioned occasionally. But they're talking the gospel of Christ. I'm flabbergasted. So I see a change happening. I see corporations spending money on training their leaders in Christ-like principles. And I'm very encouraged by that. I'm also encouraged by the emergence of cottage industries, and I support that wholeheartedly. I may do that myself. Thank you.
We'd like to thank the panelists and also thank you as participants. Thank you.